Bonjour et bienvenue au St. Emlyn's podcast. Je suis Nathalie May.
And I'm Simon Carley. Now, tonight, we're delighted to be joined by a really incredible physician, a friend of St. Emlyn's, somebody who's worked with us in the past over many years, actually, with Natalie, and that's Yuri Yordanov from Paris. Yuri, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, Natalie. Hello, Simon. My name is Yuri, as you just said. I'm an emergency physician in a university hospital in Paris called Saint-Antoine. And I was basically the doctor on shift on the Friday the 13th of November.
And of course, as everybody will know, Friday the 13th of November was a truly awful day in Paris, owing to the terrorist attacks there and the multiple casualties at several sites, including the Bataclan Theatre. Truly horrendous images, horrendous stories, and really, it's made a lot of us think over here in the UK, and I'm sure around the world, about how we would be prepared and how we would face such a dramatic event. And Yuri's doing us a fantastic favour by coming on the podcast and helping us try and understand what it was like there. And hopefully we'll pick up some things, or I'm sure we'll pick up some things, that we can take back to our departments to think about this potentially terrible event, which could sadly happen pretty much anywhere. So Yuri, Friday the 13th for yourself, and certainly in the UK, Friday the 13th has a particular meaning. It's an unlucky day, and this is an absolutely appalling day. But it wouldn't have started like that for you. I guess Friday the 13th would have started as a normal day for you?
Yeah, it was just a regular Friday evening shift with the regular case mix of patients we receive on Fridays, meaning sick and very sick patients and some drunk people that arrived quite early that evening. I can remember extremely precisely what I was doing basically when it started in my department, and I was taking care of a lady, and I was going to put a chest tube in her chest. And that's when one of my students just came in. She was quite agitated and she was screaming, "Do you want me to take care of that lady who got shot? Do you want me to take care of that lady?" I was like, "Why are you talking about people getting shot? Nobody's shooting at no one." It's like, "You're in Paris. This sounds extremely weird," and it sounded kind of nonsense. And that was basically when it all started for us.
So that experience of not really getting much notice that a major incident has taken place, I think that does surprise a lot of people in major incident management. We spend a lot of time preparing for how we're going to be notified from the scene, how we're going to get forewarning. But there are many, many examples around the world where it could literally be 30 seconds away from where you are now. And so presumably you weren't notified from the scene or from the police or anything like that. It was the patients arriving that let you know that something was going on.
Exactly. Just to describe our situation in Paris, we're a central hospital in Paris, and the shootings, or at least the two last shootings, happened 250 meters away from the hospital. So it was basically in our backyard. It was almost in the hospital. So nobody had the time to warn us, because probably nobody knew about it yet when the first patients arrived in our department. The shooting at one of the sites called La Belle Équipe was around like 40 minutes past 9, and we received our first patient at 9:47. So just 7 minutes after the shooting started, we were receiving the first patients in the ED.
And did you realize at that time that this was a major incident? I mean, clearly gunshot wounds coming into your department at any time are going to activate the staff and get people interested and move to the resus room. But did you realize the scope and the scale of the event in those early stages?
No, obviously not immediately, of course. We realized that, and I realized that personally when we received the third patient. We had this girl, this young girl that came from the first site, again, at 9:47. And then in the next 10 minutes, we received two other patients. And those two patients came from another place. And all the three of them were telling us the same story. There were some random guys shooting with war weapons, and they were shooting at us, and we were just having a drink. And again, it was another site, on the other side of the hospital, basically. So it's at that moment that we realized that something big is happening, that something bad, and probably that's going to just go worse.
So in the emergency department in the UK, we do a lot of training in emergency medicine about how to manage this situation when it arises, but none of us really expect to find ourselves in that situation. So once you'd realised that it was a bit bigger than just a couple of patients coming in with some unusual injuries, what went through your head? What did you do?
The first thing I did, basically, because I was hell scared, I was really terrified, was to start taking care of the patients. That was the 3-4 first minutes. It was some sort of sedation. I had to do something I knew how to do, and taking care of patients, trying to stabilize them, to treat the pain, that's something I know how to do. So that was really the 5 first minutes. And then afterwards, as the third patient arrived and the fourth patient was announced by my nurses, we all realized that something bigger was happening, and I realized that I had, as I was the oldest one, and I had to take charge, basically, or to step back, I don't know how to say that, and to reorganize the department and the hospital to prepare for, potentially, we didn't know how much, but lots of patients and lots of victims.
Presumably, you have, like all good hospitals, will have a major incident plan. So you're stepping back, we would say, into the role of the incident commander or the senior triage officer or the senior emergency physician to actually manage the overall aspect of that. And that does actually mean you have to step back from the direct clinical care in many cases, which I think is what you're describing.
That's exactly what I did. Yeah, I stepped back from the direct clinical care, and I was able to do this because I had enough physicians. On a regular night in my hospital, before midnight, there are 4 senior physicians. I'm not talking about residents and interns. At that moment, I just called my colleagues and called the colleagues from all over the hospital, by the way, like not only the emergency physicians, but the intensivists came and the surgeons came, and everybody came extremely fast. After 5 minutes, I had lots of physicians, lots of trained physicians, really experienced people who could handle the patient and take direct care of patients while I was taking care of the department and of the hospital and organizing the rest.
So bringing that group of people into the emergency department can be a challenge because they may not, it depends on your systems, but they may not be that familiar to working in your environment. One of the things which has been suggested is you do mixing the teams. So you make sure that each little team looking after a patient has got at least one member of the ED staff with them. So like you make sure that one of your nurses goes with the surgeon who may be down there. Is that the sort of thing that you try and do in terms of organization?
That's exactly what we did, Simon. What you're describing is basically exactly what we did because it's our multiple victims hospital plan, and because that's what looked the best thing to do at the moment it was happening. Honestly, I haven't read that plan in a couple of months, and I wasn't expecting to remember much of it. And each time I was reading, I was making fun of my head of department, saying like, hey, this is useless, this is never going to happen. And when it actually happens, it just kicked in. Like, I knew all these things, and I had to put them in place. And it appeared just so natural, and it happened, and we did it. We organized the resource room, and even the resource room wasn't big enough, so we opened another space, another area in the emergency department that we used also as a resource room. So at the maximum, at the peak of the victims who were doing the most unwell, we had 8 resource areas going on simultaneously. And for these 8 resource areas, I had at least 1 senior physician, 1 resident, 2 nurses, and we also had 1 surgeon who was giving us a hand for the triage. When I'm talking about physicians, at least one of the member of the team, as you said, was from the emergency department. Physicians or nurses.
So you've got that sort of, what I would say, the institutional intelligence within each of the teams. So it's really basic stuff like, you know, do you know where you keep this? And you kind of need that. And that, I think sometimes when I read major incident plans, that level of just the practicalities is often missed. You did talk there about triage, Yuri, because from a triage point of view, which is probably one of the few French words I do know, this would have been an incredibly challenging decision about how to treat people and prioritizing them. Who did you get to do the triage, meeting the patients at the front door?
I was doing it. Physically speaking, my position was at the entrance of the department. I had asked some of my colleagues to stay in the different areas, and we were talking to each other all the time on the phone or via our communication system within the ED. So there were always a huge exchange between us. But physically speaking, I was at the entrance. I was doing the triage, assigning patients to the different areas of the ED and to the different physicians of the ED. So I wasn't only saying that this patient was supposed to go to that area. It was the patient was going to go to the resource room and team one was going to take care of him.
Excellent. So there's a clear allocation of the patient, the priority and the location and who's going to receive them. So that closes that loop, doesn't it? And how did you keep track of the patients coming through?
That was the big that was one of the big challenge we had to face. We realized that it was going to be a challenge like 45 minutes after it started, when we realized that some of the first patients who came in, we didn't even have their names. I just had like these paper files on the stretcher on the patient with numbers. And I had numbers on the patients. So I was talking about patient one, patient two, patient three. That's when we had some help from the administrative staff of the hospital who came in at that moment. And it, like, honestly, that was quite fast when I think about it, because these people came back from their homes and they just kicked in at that time doing all the administrative part, registering the patients, giving me IDs and telling me who's who, and keeping track of the patient. In our organization, I was at the entrance, basically, and doing all the triage and organizing the department. But I also had a physician at the exit, and he was the one basically allocating the operating rooms and the destination. So that's how we kept track, because at the end, we had somebody who said, Mr. X is supposed to go in OR2, and he was the one keeping track of that.
So that administrative support, again, it's so essential during these events. And I think we can sometimes delude ourselves in major incident planning that we can do everything. But actually, doing that kind of support, that's what the admin staff do normally. So essentially what you're describing is, which I think is a really, really important point, is you've tried to normalize processes by getting the people who normally do things to keep doing them in the major incident, but just at a slightly different location with slightly different forms and processes. But you're not trying to take over somebody else's job just because it's a major incident. You're trying to get the people who are the experts to do the stuff which they're experts in.
Exactly, definitely. That's how at some point I had the feeling that everybody was, that we were working as routine. Everybody was doing what he was supposed to do, his job, and the thing that we were good at. We were just doing it on a different scale with a much larger number of victims and wounded, and even the type of wounds is something we don't see that often. But in the end, we were doing what we were supposed to do.
Just from an organization point of view, I'd probably summarize those aspects of saying that your approach here was that there's a fairly rapid recognition that something was going wrong. When there were a few patients, you just do your normal processes. But as soon as it became apparent that this is bigger, you step back, you take a control, a command, a communication, an assessment role in those early stages so that somebody's got a global picture. And then you try to make sure that people are doing the things that they normally do. So you're using people in their own expertise. And because it's bigger and because it's a different location, you've mixed your teams up to make sure there's a mixture of people from outside the department and within the department within each of those teams. And then you've used your support services to deliver the administration, to track the patients, to make sure that people are safe, that the bloods go to the right place, and you've got a record of what's coming in and a record of what's going out. You know, those are the big principles which I think make major incidents effective. You're not doing anything completely radical. What you've tried to do is upscale what you normally do on a day-to-day basis, which is great practice. Would that be a fair summary?
That's a brilliant summary. I wouldn't have said it better, Simon.
Yuri, I think it's a great description of what happened. But Natalie, you wanted to cover some other aspects, I think.
Yeah, I was quite interested in what you did with your patients. So first of all, you talked about those really rapid appearance of those first patients. Were they coming, I take it, not by ambulance, but they were walking in? And was that the pattern that you were seeing through the evening?
The first patients came in walking. They came in by cab. Some of them came in by like Uber and those kind of cab services. And then the first ambulances came a little bit later. But it was mixed, basically. But definitely the first ones came in like by their own means.
And so did that have an impact on how sick they were? Were you seeing the least sick ones first and then the sicker ones later when the ambulances could get to them? Or was it pretty random.
No, actually, it was quite random, at least in the beginning, because there was like the physicians and the EMS on site weren't probably there yet. So the first ones we received were actually quite severely wounded. And then afterwards, when the pre-hospital phase was in place and was set up, at that moment, yes, we received, there were a pre-hospital triage that was already done. And we had an idea of the severity of the various patients. But at the beginning, yeah, it was just honestly totally random.
I'm still thinking about that lady. What did you do with her and all the other patients who I presume were in your department of a Friday evening before all this started?
My wonderful lady, when I was taking care of her, as everything happened at that moment, and I called my colleagues from the rest of the hospital, when the head of the ICU, who was actually on shift that night, arrived, of the medical ICU arrived, I was like, hey, by the way, I'm going to ask my team just to get that lady to your department because she's going to need a chest tube and that's the kind of thing you're going to do. If I don't do it here, you're going to do it in the ICU and that's going to be better because I need the room for, I need to get the patient somewhere and I need the room for the incoming patients. So that's what we did with that very nice lady. She went to the ICU extremely fast after it happened. And that's what basically we did with most of the patients who needed bedding.
And I know if you came to my emergency department of a Friday evening, you'd certainly see some patients who didn't need to be admitted. We still get minor injuries at that time on a Friday evening. What, did you have those patients as well? And what did you do with those?
Yes, definitely. We had these patients. I was telling you earlier, we are lucky because we're four senior physicians from the emergency department on shift on a Friday evening. As we had lots of reinforcements from the rest of the hospital, I asked one of my physicians to handle these patients and to take care of these patients, to make sure they're seen, they're assessed, they're treated, and then they could go back to their place. Actually, they weren't going back to their place. We were asking them to stay in the waiting room because we didn't know what was happening outside. We didn't know it was safe to let them go back home, so we were discharging them and asking them to wait in the waiting room of the emergency department.
Yeah, I suppose that's something that we don't normally think about. Often our hospital major incident plans say clear out the waiting room of everyone who can walk, go home, go somewhere else, but actually that might not be a safe thing for them to do, exactly as you've described for us. And was it purely patients then from the incident that you were getting as soon as things started, or did you still have patients turning up with other complaints that weren't related to what was going on outside?
The geographical situation of our hospital made it extremely difficult for other patients to access hospital afterwards, because there were police all over the place, and to access the hospital, even some of the physicians, of my physicians who were coming in to give us a hand, told us stories where basically the police was pointing guns at them and they were lying on the floor before they could give an ID and say, I'm a physician and I'm going to the hospital to give a hand. So I suppose that most of the patients would have had problems to get in, but some of them did manage to get in. We took care of them, but in some cases, and I have one particular story in mind, so we had the regular patients who came in, and some of them, when they saw the activity, the wounded patients, just didn't want to bother us and went back home and just went to see their GP or came to the emergency department on the days that followed.
It sounds like what you've said there is that, as well as all of the major incident planning that's gone into your brain in terms of dealing with these huge numbers of injured patients, you still have to be wary of the day-to-day functioning of your emergency department. That side doesn't stop necessarily, and there are all those other considerations that you've had to factor in when you've made the decisions that you've made in looking after people. So Simon, what other aspects of major incident planning and dealing with major incidents do you think we could ask Yuri about that might be useful for us?
Well, I think we might have to come back and have a greater think about sort of planning and lessons learned from the process. But I think the other thing which I'd be very interested to know about today, and I think lots of people would be interested to know, is this was certainly in Europe a very unusual pattern of injury, with both a combination presumably of shrapnel wounds, of ballistic injuries, and possibly some blast injuries. That's not something we see a lot of in the UK, and pretty certain you don't see it in Paris as well. And that must have been quite a challenge for you about just the medical management of these patients.
It is true that we don't see these kind of wounds extremely, extremely often in Europe and in civilian hospitals. But in the end, it wasn't such a big challenge. Especially when we're talking about gunshot wounds and ballistic wounds. How do you say this? Like a local hemostasis, and we were using tourniquets and compression, and until we managed to have an OR ready. And that's basically what we were doing, because that's one of the surprising thing is that the vast majority of the wounds were limb wounds. It was extremities wounds. We didn't have that much thoracal wounds or abdominal wounds. It was mostly limbs.
And I think in the Lancet article, it does mention that as well, doesn't it? And that those patients who were sadly received head wounds, the mortality was very high. And I presume many of those may not have actually come in that wave of casualties to hospital. So in the ED phase, what you're describing is doing basic, good quality emergency medicine well, making decisions to stabilize the patients, and basically being good resuscitationists in the resus room with good overall management and stabilizing them ready for theatre. Who made the decisions about who goes to theatre and when? Was that done with the ED physicians, or is that the surgical teams and the anaesthetic teams coming together?
It was basically all of us together. We were lucky enough, we had enough surgeons, so one of them was physically present with us in the resus room during the whole process. And he was the one doing the prioritization when it came to the surgical emergency. But when the patient was unstable, definitely it was the decision of the trauma leader or the team leader who came to talk to the person doing the supervision in the resus room, saying that this patient is definitely the most unstable and he's the one who needs to go as fast as possible to the operating theater. That was for the very unstable patients. For the other type of patients, the ones that were a little bit more stable or that we managed to stabilize, for these patients, the prioritization was done essentially by the surgeon.
What we're describing there is multiple levels of triage. You're doing your triage at the front door, then there's triage during the resuscitation process, and then there's triage once that initial stabilization or difficulty in stabilization has taken place to then go to theatre and ICU. So this is, I think, when people sometimes think about major incident triage, they think it as a single event. But what you're describing very nicely is that this needs to be done again and again and again as patients reprioritize or we get or don't get stability.
Exactly.
The challenge there, of course, is we've talked about capacity in the ED, but you've also then got capacity in theatres. Did you have to deliver care in unusual settings? So were you doing more procedures in the ED than you normally do? Or were you just trying to, as we described before, keep to standard practice and deliver the best care?
No, we managed to keep our standard of care untouched. That's one of the bits I'm maybe the more proud of. We did what we usually do, but on a bigger scale. We patients, like, the best place to treat a patient with the surgical needs is in the operating room, and we managed to do this. We haven't had to do some crazy stuff in the ED or unusual stuff in the ED. Everything was done in the OR when the patient needed to go to the OR, and that's the nice part. When it all started, we quickly opened three operating rooms, operating theaters, and quite fast we were recalling people from the outside. But then some people presented spontaneously because they were having drinks or living next to the hospital, and they presented. Among them, some were physicians and some were surgeons. And these surgeons, who didn't know our operating theater, became handy with our surgeons. They organized the surgical teams as we did in the ED. Meaning that they had one surgeon from the hospital, but he was assisted from people that were working in other hospitals.
So that's keeping that same principle of trying to get routine and mixing your teams. It's really, I mean, we spend a lot of time thinking about major incidents, but it is really heartening to hear that the principles that you've applied are the ones that we would suggest to anybody, really. But delivering it on the day is an incredible challenge. Hats off, chapeau to everybody there. That is another French word which I know from cycling, but there aren't many. I mean, in all seriousness, you know, though, we can, as emergency physicians around the world, as emergency clinicians, EMS, we can all put ourselves in the imaginary space of what it must have been like. And I think nobody who's been involved in this kind of thing before, who's dealt with critically injured patients, can underestimate the challenges which you and your team faced. And I think what you've described, what we've seen, what we can read in the Lancet article is an incredible sign of your skill, preparation and response. And I think you must be very proud, not just of yourself, but of the team and the group of people who you deal with.
That's the first thing I thought of when I was leaving the hospital at 7 in the morning on the next day, was that I was incredibly proud to be part of that team. At no moment I thought about myself, obviously, Simon. It was really being proud of something bigger than our department, bigger than our hospital. At this moment, almost the totality of the hospitals, of our group of hospitals, because we're like a huge group called Assistance Publique des Hôpitaux de Paris, we were all working together. Again, we had surgeons from other hospitals who came in just because they were living near here and saying, I can do something, I can help you. And we saw this, we saw our students, we saw residents, we saw nurses, everybody coming in spontaneously, giving a hand. And that was really heartwarming.
I think it's close to a good place to end this section of the podcast, if that's okay. The only other group that I think we really do need to sort of mention is, these events are incredibly challenging for us professionally. They're incredibly challenging, but we cannot forget the victims of the incident, their relatives, their families, and the people of Paris who have suffered greatly. And I think, you know, everybody who'll be listening to the podcast, everybody around the world, recognizes that their sacrifices and the terrible events that happened will always be with us. But thankfully, for people like you and your team, I suspect that the death rate was considerably less than it could have been. So thank you, Yuri. But, you know, please, our thoughts to everybody in Paris and your team and the great work you do.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Natalie.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We hope to get Yuri back on the podcast again in the future. Many, many things to think about there. Great thoughts, really good principles of major incident planning. But let's not forget the humanity of what was a terrible situation. Thank you.